What I first want you to do is answer this question. The text that we're using today is Exodus 20, verse 13. You shall not murder. You shall not murder. I want you to discuss in your small groups why you think God gave this commandment. I need somebody to kind of be the transcriber here. I'm going to give you a couple of questions to ponder here. So I want you to, everybody have a kind of lead guy in the group, pencil or pen, put it on the paper. Here we go. Number one, first discuss why you think God gave this commandment. Why do you think God gave this commandment? You remember that God is establishing a nation here. He's led them out of Egypt, Vincent, and He's led them to a new land, and now He's establishing the way this land is going to run. His intention and His idea is that He would have the privilege and the honor of being their king. That God was going to be the king of this nation and establish a theocracy. And so He's giving commandments. And first He gives the big commandments, and then He gives the explanations and the derivatives and all the, you know, the way this commandment looks in society and everyday living. But here in the Ten Commandments, He gives us the big structure. And so here we go. We just finished the fifth commandment, which is you shall honor your father and mother, the number one horizontal commandment. And now we get to the number two horizontal commandment for society's benefit. And that number two commandment is you shall not murder. Why? The other thing I want you to discuss is, what is God trying to achieve with this? What's God trying to achieve here? I want you to imagine being among the government leaders. Let's say that this is a high-powered room where we have high-powered government officials here, all here, and here we are in our cabinet and deciding how this is going to work in our new nation. The way this is going to apply to all the people out there who are following us, it lands in your hands, people. You guys hold the keys to how this is going to play out, whether it's going to play well or play unsuccessfully. You shall not murder. So I want you to discuss, as you're thinking of how this will play out with the people that you are leading, what kind of issues come to mind? What can you anticipate? What questions do you think will come up? How would you go about defining do not murder? And you know how people are. They're going to be looking for loopholes. What loopholes can you anticipate with this commandment? You're going to have to define murder. Is all killing murder? You're going to have to distinguish these things. So these are the things I want you to discuss right now in your group as kind of members of the cabinet and anticipating how the playing out of this commandment is going to fall. Okay? So go ahead and take some time to do that. Engage in some discussion. Put your thinking caps on. The more you can get into this, the better you're going to understand what God has in mind. And the better you understand what God has in mind, the better you understand God. The better you understand God, the better life is. So go ahead. Just you guys discussed, what are some of the issues that came up? And I don't know that you come to a resolution necessarily today, or in these few minutes, but we want to find out what emerges as you're kind of trying to think this through. Anybody? What are some things that you guys discussed so we can run our nation better? More cleanly, more according to what God had in mind, more efficiently? What are the things that you discussed? Anybody? Go ahead, let's bring it up. Let's go. Different levels of murder. I got someone even standing here, so I'll take him. Okay, hold on. Shh. You say it again?
You're saying why God put this commandment, put the commandment there. Mm-hmm. It says that life is a blessing.
Okay.
And that is not for us to take the life, but for him, because it's not our choice to take when he shall depart from this earth. And also, human life is valuable, and we're created in the image of God, so if we murder, it's like kind of defiling him, maybe.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we had a lot of questions.
Yeah, like what?
Like, war, is it right, like, to kill people in war, or is it right to murder in self-defense? Yeah.
Huh. That's almost like an oxymoron. Is it right to murder in self-defense? Maybe. Depending on what you define murder as, right? Okay, good. What other issues come up? That's a good general statement. I could, if I had a kind of a sneaky mind, or at least a mind that was trying to get in between the reading between the lines, I might try to find a way to justify that what I did is not technically murder. Maybe. What other points of discussion did you guys come up with? Yes.
Try and hurt you out of like fear, and then you end up killing them and saying, "Oh, it was in self-defense,"
and
that's wrong.
Mm, okay, so you came up with kind of an exception that somebody could try to run around. Okay. Yes.
I could have discussed a lot, and then we just compiled like a really big definition for murder.
Okay, good. I want to hear it. A really big definition. You might have to stand for this one. And speak up, speak loud.
Any action or non-action that takes away or causes the death of another person, provoked or unprovoked, with intention and generally characterized by malice or any form of discontent.
Did John give that to you?
No,
we
had
that already. We had that before? We got to consult our resident attorney here. Anybody else? How about the ladies here?
Well, our group talked about capital punishment, and we were saying, is that murder? But then Clara said that capital punishment actually supports the commandment, you shall not murder, because if someone murders someone, you're stopping them from doing it more by the capital punishment. And also, if you don't punish them with capital punishment, then you're almost saying that the person they murdered, life isn't valued that much, that it wouldn't be a life for a life, because let's say someone murders someone and then you don't do capital punishment on that person, then it's almost like, oh, that wasn't a big deal that you murdered that person. Then I was thinking about the thing about war, at least in the Old Testament, we kind of stumbled upon that, but then actually war is maybe a form of capital punishment in a way, because I bet most of the nations that they fought, also they themselves brutally murdered a lot of people. I'm sure they were, these nations that were pretty brutal themselves,
ruthless.
So maybe God was judging them by killing them because of the murder that they did.
Yes.
Matthew 5:21, Jesus says that, like, even if you don't kill someone, but you think that you fool in your heart, then you're already murdering them, like, in your heart. And we decided that life isn't just, like, your time on earth, but your internal, eternal life as well. So, like not bringing someone to God when you feel like they need him, and neglecting evangelism is also a form of murder, because you're not bringing them to God. And so when they die, they're not going to have eternal life.
Did you guys get that or no?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, say that again.
We also discussed Genesis 1:27. Man is made in the image of God, and if you murder someone, then you're murdering someone who was made in the image of God.
So?
It's sort of an attack on God. By killing something that is made to
life. Okay. Did you guys think of any questions that might arise if you try to unveil this and roll this out to the people? You think this is going to fly? Do you think, how long do you think it's going to be before someone says, that it wasn't exactly in the rules there? If that long, huh? What does Scripture say? I think you guys have been looking up some verses and passages about what Scripture says about murder. Well, what does the United States say about murder? Well, John is an attorney, and how'd you do in crim law anyway?
I did okay.
You did okay? Okay. There are kind of 3 degrees of murder. Can you explain first degree, second degree?
I can try. Well, what I was sharing in the press conference was that the highest form of murder, or the worst form of murder, is premeditated murder. That's where you take a life and you were lying in wait and planning out the attack. And the second level, or the second worst, I guess, would be when you murder someone in the heat of passion. So that's when you catch someone doing something that you find really atrocious, and you get really, really angry, and without thinking, you grab a knife or a gun, and you kill the person. And the third level would probably be what's known as manslaughter, and that's when you kill someone on accident. But that can kind of be divided into involuntary and voluntary manslaughter. So involuntary manslaughter would be like if you're driving a car and someone on the sidewalk all of a sudden jumps out in front of your car and you run them over. You killed them, but you didn't mean to kill them. And then voluntary manslaughter would be where, let's say you went to a party, you had a little too much to drink, so you got drunk, and then you're driving home and someone jumps out from the sidewalk and you kill them. So you didn't mean to kill the person, but you did mean to get intoxicated and lose control. So you're a little bit more responsible in that way, although you didn't have the intention to kill them. So the degrees are basically divided. The degrees of murder are basically divided up into categories based on the person's intent. But I think that's generally what I remember.
Hey, you know, that's exactly what I have in my notes. Exactly. So very good. You did. I'm sure you did pretty well. I don't even have to go over it, because that's exactly what I have there. What seems to separate the degrees of murder? What seems to be the linchpin that separates first degree from second degree, or second degree from manslaughter? What does the law seem to be looking at? Okay. What is the significance of it being thought out? Okay, the mindset. Explain.
Like, when you're intentionally going to kill someone, then you are, in your mindset, like, really negative and thinking evil thoughts and really hating the person. But when you're doing it in the heat of passion, you also really hate the person, but it was kind of like you weren't expecting that kind of thing. And I think for, like, seconds before, you wouldn't want to kill that person, but then you knew that the chance of occurrence that happened, then you would...
Okay.
Not just planning out the action of killing someone, but maybe finding the best way possible to hurt them to really, like, try taking their life.
Okay.
So it's like against them, not just trying to get rid of
Okay. Now, why the distinction? Why does that make a difference? You know, manslaughter, second degree, first degree. Why does that make a difference? The result's the same. The guy's dead. Why does that make a difference? Why not say, hey, you kill a guy for whatever reason, shape, or form. That's it. He's dead, so you be dead too. Why the degrees? Why have, you know, life sentences and 2 life sentences? I mean, what does that accomplish? You know, whether you have 180 years in prison or 260 years in prison. I mean... You know, I don't see what's the difference. Why delineate? What's the point of judging intent?
Because
Why does it count? Let's make it a little simpler and less permanent. But if somebody does something to you, accidentally harms you, trips you by accident or on purpose, the same result occurs. You fall flat on your face. But does it make a difference to you whether they did it on accident or on purpose? Lynette, you say it does. Why does it make a difference to you? Okay, yeah. But why does that make you feel better? Okay. So you're saying that you're flat on your face both ways. It hurts both ways physically, but one hurts more actually. Because you're saying even though you can't feel it physically, there is a feeling that is coming of animosity, of some intangible passion coming your way and you feel it. Something like that. It works in reverse too, doesn't it? If someone does something to bless you, or if they did it by accident and it happened to bless you, but they didn't really mean it, but it means more when you know somebody had you on their heart, huh? Life is funny that way because we're all about intent, and in fact, the Lord is all about intention. That's why the Lord, you know, what's that line, Kathy? You know, God makes a big deal about people honoring Him with their lips, but their hearts are far from Him. If all He wants is verbal praise and verbal honor, everybody here can do that and has done it. But yet God seems dissatisfied. I'm quite sure He's dissatisfied with a lot of our worship that we give Him. Though the song sounds good and the words are spoken, and so thus honor is given to Him, but somehow He's reading an intangible quality that is different and means a lot more to Him than the words spoken. And yet He demands the words spoken, but He demands it from a heart that precedes that, doesn't He? Because He says, give thanks, not just be thankful. Something to do with the intention and the sincerity of your action. What does Scripture say about murder, accidental death? Numbers chapter 35, verses 15 through 25. Listen to the word of the Lord here. It says this: these six towns will be a place of refuge for Israelites, aliens, and any other people living among them, so that anyone who has killed another accidentally can flee there. Pay attention and make note of what you hear. Anyone who has killed another accidentally can flee there. If a man strikes someone with an iron object so that he dies, he's a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. Or if anyone has a stone in his hand that could kill, and he strikes someone so that he dies, he's a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. Or if anyone has a wooden object in his hand that could kill, and he hits someone so that he dies, he's a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. The avenger of blood shall put the murderer to death. When he meets him, he shall put him to death. If anyone with malice aforethought, there's first degree, right? Malice aforethought, premeditated, and malice pre-thought out, stewed over, and carried out. If anyone with malice aforethought shoves another person or throws something at him intentionally so that he dies, or if in hostility he hits him with his fist so that he dies, that person shall be put to death. He's a murderer. The avenger of blood shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. But if without hostility, someone suddenly shoves another without hostility, or throws something at him unintentionally, like, here, catch, oops, or without seeing him, drops a stone that could kill him, like, out his window, oops, and watch out below, that could kill him, and he dies, then since he was not his enemy, and he did not intend to harm him, the assembly must judge then between him and the avenger of blood according to these regulations. The assembly must protect the one accused of murder from the avenger of blood and send him back to the city of refuge to which he fled. He must stay there until the death of the high priest who is anointed with holy oil. Someone mentioned self-defense over here. Exodus 22, 2 through 3 says, if a thief is caught breaking in and is struck so that he dies, the defender is not guilty of bloodshed. But if it happens after sunrise, he is guilty of bloodshed. A thief must certainly make restitution, but if he has nothing, he must be sold to pay for his theft. Actually, in the United States court system, I have a good sneaking suspicion this guy will go scot-free anyway. Because you know, there's been cases out there in our country that are ludicrous. Guys breaking into houses, falling because he broke in and he broke his arm or something, falling through the window, and then he sued the people in the house for, and then, you know, he wins. You know, you've read crazy cases like that. And, you know, this guy cuts his arm breaking through their window, and now, you know, it's their fault for having the kind of window that cuts people. I mean, it's ridiculousness. Yeah, our in the classic Twinkie defense. I don't know if you guys studied that. But anyway, our court systems are quite strange. What is the word for murder? In fact, earlier translations use the word "thou shall not kill." Other translations say "thou shall not murder." There is a difference, isn't there? But the way we translate it isn't the difference. We've got to go find out what was actually written. The Greek word is ratsach. Oh, I don't have my pen. Ratsach. Which is, I mean, not the Greek, I'm sorry, the Hebrew word. R-A-T-S-A-C-H. And there's a little controversy sometimes over whether the Hebrew word should be translated to kill or murder. So I just looked it up for us. Here's what it says in the dictionary. Ratsach. To murder. To slay, to kill. To murder, to slay. Premeditated, accidental, as an avenger, a slayer, intentional. To be slain, to murder, to assassinate, to be killed. So there's that word there, ratsach. Using some of our definitions here, I want you to go back just in your small groups for a few more minutes and understanding what murder is more clearly now, thanks to John. I want you to go back and I want you to discuss a little bit the issues of abortion and euthanasia. Think about that for a second. I want you to discuss it for a few minutes and we'll come back. Do this. It's not so that you can be conclusive today. In fact, you're going to carry out these discussions in your small groups in a couple weeks. But I did want to bring the kind of the, you know, the sensitivity to the issues here. It's not easy, is it? There's always, what if this? What if that? There's, it's not an easy thing. I'm on the morning of February 25th, 1990, approximately 4:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Terry collapsed in a hallway of their St. Petersburg apartment. Firefighters and paramedics arriving in response to Michael's 911 call found her face down and unconscious. She was not breathing and she had no pulse. They attempted to resuscitate her. She was defibrillated several times and she was transported to the Humana Northside Hospital. There she was intubated, ventilated, and eventually given a tracheotomy. The long period without oxygen led to profound brain injury, severely damaging the parts of the brain concerned with cognition, perception, and awareness. The cause of her cardiac arrest has never been determined, but her lack of balanced nourishment has always been suspected. The possibility of strangulation or domestic violence were investigated at the scene, but no evidence was found. For a time, it was believed that her cardiac arrest had been caused by an imbalance of electrolytes in her blood. On admission to a hospital, her serum potassium level was noted to be very low. Her sodium and calcium levels were normal. Her medical chart contained a note that she apparently has been trying to keep her weight down with dieting by herself, drinking liquids most of the time during the day and drinking about 10 to 15 glasses of iced tea. Iced tea is a mild diuretic. That is, it is a food that causes fluid loss. It was unclear whether she had bulimia. Terry Schiavo's husband later filed and won a malpractice suit against her obstetrician on the basis that the physician failed to recognize and diagnose bulimia in her. In 1992, the jury awarded $1 million. And by 1993, Schiavo had the money from the lawsuit. Schiavo remained comatose for 2.5 months. When she emerged from the coma, Schiavo regained a sleep-wake cycle but did not exhibit repeatable and consistent awareness of herself or her environment. While initially fed by means of a nasogastric feeding tube, she eventually received a PEG feeding tube inserted through the abdominal wall. The doctor cared for Schiavo during her initial admission to Humana. Both he and another doctor, an internist, and the Schiavo family physician independently made the diagnosis of a persistent vegetative state, PVS, within approximately 1 year after Schiavo's cardiac arrest. Other neurologists examined Schiavo also over the years and made the same diagnosis. They also shared an opinion about her very poor chances for recovery. Ronald Cranford, a neurologist and an expert on coma and unconsciousness, testified in 2005 that nothing in the medical record suggested disagreement among Terry's physicians about the underlying diagnosis. The Terry Schiavo case was a 7-year-long successful legal effort by Michael Schiavo to have his wife Terry, already diagnosed as being in persistent vegetative state for several years, disconnected from life support. Now, while as early as 1993, Michael, as Terry's guardian, had entered a do not resuscitate order for her, which she was soon convinced to have rescinded, in 1998 he petitioned under Florida law to remove her feeding tube. The parents of Terry Schiavo, Robert and Mary Schindler, opposed this, arguing that Terry was still conscious. Michael later ceded authority over the matter to the court, which determined that Terry would not wish to continue life prolonging measures. After the initial 5-year struggle by the family members, where the feeding tube had been removed for a few days, the governments of Florida and later the United States passed laws that sought unsuccessfully to reverse subsequent removals of Schiavo's feeding tube. The periods leading up to these lawmaking efforts received publicity, included involvement by politicians and advocacy groups, particularly those involved in pro-life or disability rights causes. The federal government's significant involvement during 2005 in a last-ditch effort to keep her alive, with President Bush traveling from vacation back to Washington, D.C., specifically to sign the legislation, made it a major national news story throughout the month. By 2005, in March, the legal history around the Schiavo case included 14 appeals, numerous motions, petitions, hearings in the Florida courts, 5 suits in the federal district court, Florida legislation struck down the Supreme Court of Florida, a subpoena by the Congressional Committee to qualify Schiavo for witness protection, federal legislation, 4 denials from the Supreme Court of the United States. The local court's decision to disconnect Shival from life support was carried out on March 18, 2005. And Shival died of effects of dehydration at the Pinellas Park Hospice on March 31st. That's 13 days later, 2005. Some of you may remember the urgency behind that case. There's no doubt that there are difficult questions to deal with when we're dealing with life. There are no easy answers. I had to deal with that same issue with my father in 2001, whether to keep him on life support or keep the morphine going. The questions are very hard. They're very confusing. And the real issues oftentimes are as clear as mud. But we do need to continuously strive to fight, to try to arrive at answers. We need to work hard to uncover God's thoughts and use His own infallible and inerrant word to find the way to those thoughts. It's not easy, but what we do have to do is at least go back to the basics. We have to go back to the foundational tenets of this commandment. What is the real issue here? What is the real issue behind this commandment? Well, of course there's the issue of stealing, right? There is the issue of stealing. When you take another's life, you're taking that which does not belong to you. That violates the eighth commandment, you shall not steal. Of such importance is this command, you shall not murder, that the violation of this commandment resulted in the institution of capital punishment. Genesis 9:6 says, "Whoever sheds a man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed." Exodus 21:12-20. It's interesting to note, you know, these are further expansions of the Ten Commandments, but you know, you can listen up. Exodus 21. I'll read some for you and see if you notice anything interesting. Verse 12 says, "He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him," premeditation, malice aforethought, "but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint you a place to which he may flee. If, however, a man acts presumptuously towards his neighbor, so as to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar that he may die. And he who strikes his father or mother surely shall be put to death. He who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or he is found in his possession, shall surely be put to death. He who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. And if men have a quarrel and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die but remains in bed, if he gets up and walks around outside on his staff, then he who struck him shall go unpunished. He shall only pay for the loss of time and shall take care of him until he is completely healed. But if a man strikes his male or female slave with a rod and he dies at his hand, he shall be punished. The Lord thinks this commandment is sufficient to warrant a violation of it to be worthy of your death. Why is it that we are allowed? I think this group, I heard this group ask this question, but why is it that we are allowed to kill animals and not humans? What's the difference? Well, why not humans for food?
Animals weren't made in the image of God.
Animals what?
Animals
weren't made in the image of God, Joshua says. I didn't finish Genesis 9:6. Genesis 9:6 says, "Whoever sheds a man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed." What's the reason? Here's the end of 9:6. For in the image of God, He made man. There it is. In the image of God, He made man. I want you to think and consider for a second, what does it mean to be made in the image of God? It wasn't but a few weeks ago at church, earlier this year in 2009, that I walked through down the door, you know, the hallway, and then down the aisle, and this is before church, and there's an elderly couple sitting in the front row who have not been to our church for 20, 30 years or so. And then they get up, and I'm walking. I've never seen these guys in my life, and they're an elderly couple, and I walk, and the man goes up to me, or I think maybe it's the wife who says to me, "You're Xie Guozhen's son, aren't you?" "Yes, I am." "How is your father?" I said, he died, you know, in 2001. "Oh, I'm so sorry." I said, "How'd you know?" He says, "You look just like him. I can tell immediately just from watching, you're his son." Some people tell my sons they can tell that they're my kids like that. I don't know if you see that, but other people see that. But let me tell you something. When that person attributed my image to my father's, you know what happened to me? I started talking to them, and I still had in my mind a conscious awareness to be extra nice, to make sure my dad's name was and reputation, you know what I mean? I had that kind of consciousness to make my dad proud. So you keep that in mind, all right? You know, it's instinctive in me that you bear the image of one and you carry that name out. Do you ever think like that? Do you ever think cognizantly of the one whose image you bear? Of representing him accurately? Of understanding that when people see you, they may be looking and forming an opinion of the image of the one you bear? Today I read on an atheist website, he was so happy to report this, but in a study that was done, it says private internet pornography is just as high amongst evangelical Christians as it is with non-Christians. There is no difference. The one difference is this: for Christians, their use on Sunday goes down 1%. I guess they understand the holiness of the Lord's Day. But it goes right back up on Monday. That the most conservative states, the states that vote most conservatively, were actually the highest users of internet porn. In fact, the number one state in the country is Utah. And they were making the observations and doing the studies, because what they did is they were able to trace, and they got all the credit card records, able to trace it down right down to the very zip codes that they lived in and all these different things, and they do these filtering and being able to get data out of this so that they can analyze and see how to target different groups. But the atheists didn't even have to say much. It was just like, aha, read this, guys. This stuff is bunk. This Christianity stuff is bunk. You guys live the same way as we do. It's no different. We are made in the image of God. And with that statement, we have the foundational principle of all human rights and all human dignity and all other rules, all other commands, all other laws that naturally follow, including the command not to murder. You understand that humans are valuable in this way, in that we are image bearers. And that is exactly what distinguishes us from all other beings on the planet. That we bear the image of the only eternal, only uncaused, only sovereign, only wise, only holy one. And His image is on us. Turn to Mark chapter 12. Mark chapter 12. As you're turning to it, guys, That's why I'm going to continue to hammer you on your virtual social, whatever, Facebook, Zynga, MySpace, his face, all that stuff. You guys are, I'm just telling you as it is, you guys are not representing him well on those places, okay? I'm just telling you, I get to see it every so often, and this is not representing him well. It's just not. And you guys got to understand that. You think it's all about you, and that's the subtle seduction, because it's my space. It's my tube. It's my face. It's my book. And it's all about me. Little things, even as innocuous as it may seem, but it's still little, this me. And I you know, it's like the Tower of Babel all over again, where Satan is bringing everybody together and unifying us and connecting us together. So they're one big community, like they did, like the people did in the Tower of Babel. And God saw them coming together, and we all want unity. And so they were unifying, and God says, we've got to spread them apart. Distinction is good. It is good to be different. And so we had to spread them apart and confuse their language, because we were going to be unified against them. And that's exactly what I see happening all over again, but under the guise of just little unity amongst ourselves. But I'm telling you this, if we're supposed to be unified on anything in this world, it's to be unified on Jesus Christ. Christians are our only source, our only reason, our only basis for unity is Jesus Christ. I did not see, at any time I've ever been on, I've never seen a unifying of Christians around Jesus Christ. I've seen NBCLA's blog stuff and circles and rings and all that stuff. I've never seen unification around Jesus Christ. Have you? If it isn't, then what's the difference? And yet, we lose so much ground. I can go into this a little bit more later sometime, and sometime I may. Okay, but I'm just saying, we've got to keep understanding who we represent. Verse 13. They sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to him, Jesus that is, in order to trap him in a statement. And they came and they said to him, "Teacher, we know that you are truthful and you defer to no one, for you are not partial to any." Boy, his like, he must be just like gagging in his mouth. "But you teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful to pay a poll tax to Caesar or not? Shall we pay or shall we not pay?" But Jesus, the all-wise Jesus, our Jesus, knowing their hypocrisy, knowing what they were trying to do, said to them, "Why are you testing me? Go ahead, come here. Bring me a denarius to look at." Anybody got a coin on them right now? "Bring me a denarius to look at." A denarius, Joseph! And Joseph brought one. And Jesus said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" And they said to him, "Caesar." They said to him, "Caesar's." And here was what Jesus said, "Render to Caesar then the things that are Caesar's. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. The coin bears his image, so it belongs to him. It represents him. So give it to him then." The coin bears his image. Whose image do you bear? Then give it to him and render to God what is due him. You belong to him. Because you and I are made in the Imago Dei. in the image of God. And all that that entails, if you can get your mind around that, that's mind-shattering stuff. I bear the image of God. And so, was it Emily that read Matthew 5? I don't remember who. So you go and you translate this into the New Testament, this idea of murder, and the Jews had already perfected their ins and outs. They perfected how they were going to perform not murdering people. And Jesus says, hey, I've got the real standard for you here. Matthew 5:21. Jesus says, hey, you've heard it. You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, right? Whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. Well, I say to you this, everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. Everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. Whoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be guilty before the court, the Supreme Court. And whoever shall say, you fool, fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. What does this mean? I call someone a fool and I'm going to hell? Commentator David Guzik writes this, whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in the danger of the judgment. The teaching of the scribes and Pharisees was true enough, you shall not murder. Yet they also taught that anything short of murder might be allowed. So Jesus corrects this, and he makes it clear that it is not only those who commit the act of murder who are in danger of judgment, but those who have a murderous intent in the heart are also in danger of the judgment. So Jesus exposes the essence of the scribes' heresy. To them, the law was really only a matter of external performance and never the heart. Jesus brings the law back to the matters of the heart. We should emphasize that Jesus is not saying here that anger is as bad as murder, because it's ridiculous to think that someone who shouts at another person in anger has sinned as badly as someone who has actually murdered the other person in anger. Jesus is emphasizing that the law condemns both, though, without saying that the law says that they are the same things. Commentators have translated the idea behind the word raca as nitwit, blockhead, numbskull, bonehead, brainless idiot, and whatever else we can think of today. Let me ask you for a second. Think about this for a moment. Here what this is basically saying, Jesus is basically saying is, when you are angry beyond what is legitimate, when you are angry beyond what is legitimate, without just cause, you've got murderous intent on your heart, and he judges that. Have any of you ever been angry beyond what is legitimate? I'm the first to raise my hand for that. But think about this for a moment. Why is it that murder is disallowed in the Bible? Why is it that murder is disallowed? Hey guys, I mean, what if he hurt me? He hurt me. Sufficient reason enough? He broke my toy. Sufficient reason enough? He stole my car. And I saved up all my summer savings for the last 4 years for. Sufficient reason enough? He broke into my house. Let's get worse. He broke my arm. How about he broke my neck? Is that, are we getting closer? Is that sufficient enough reason? Why not? Why isn't that sufficient enough reason yet for murder? Okay. The point being?
If you realize, then you're not, then you're, then you're,
Okay. That's the bottom line. He didn't take your life. And so therefore you have the laws in Matthew 5:38, and time's running short, but the Exodus 21:24, which tell us an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Sometimes a non-Christian or a young Christian will say, hey, I thought you were supposed to turn the other cheek. I thought you were supposed to be people of forgiveness. Why an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth? Isn't that contradictory? But what is happening here is Jesus and the prophets are putting limits on the retribution you can take. Because I tell you, you come after one of my kids and you're going, man, my anger is seething and raging. I might kill you. Right? You go hit someone like that, then the Bible's saying, hold on. You lost a tooth, right? It's a tooth. A tooth for a tooth. Not a life for a tooth. An eye for an eye. Okay, you lost your eye. Your eye's out, but not your life. And these were setting the limits and the parameters, limiting the kind of retribution that would take place. But you never have the right to go beyond what was done to you. Because that is God's realm. He alone has the right to life. Life is His to give and His to take. So we are not allowed to further mar nor damage the image of God than that which has already been done and marred by the one who perpetrated the crime himself. If you're angry with a person without cause or unduly angry, it is the same root of murder, according to Jesus here. So it's going beyond our right. So if you're angry beyond what you should be angry about, what you are guilty of is killing a relationship or marring an image beyond what it is. We're trying to defame an image of God beyond what that person already did to himself. Even if it's in your own eyes. Since we are God's and we bear His image, therefore we have no right, no authority to decide when someone is not worthy of living. We cannot judge people based on their abilities. That's not our realm. Or their lack of abilities. Today, we have a situation in Europe coming to a city near you over here shortly where laws are being passed and have been passed to dispense of the elderly in a more quick manner. There are also laws that allow the people with disabilities who, quote-unquote, have no use in society, who are draining the resources of society. And if you've ever been around people with disabilities or elderly people, they require a lot of money. It's a big investment of capital to continue to have them live. And so the rationale goes, they're old already, they're not useful anymore, they don't even function, and they don't even like living like this anymore. Let's help them to commit their suicide. Let's expedite this, and in that way, we can help our economy as well. I only imagine with the global economic collapse that we're in right now, that those kind of laws may be even more heightened because the strap on finances is great. And they take the greatest amount. What we have here is a utilitarian approach that what kind of contribution do they give? They suck. They don't give anything. What value is there? We need to be building ourselves and our lives for something. And it's got to be more than for ourselves, guys. We need to be building the ability, the skill, and the art of advocating for those who cannot advocate for themselves. Their right to exist is being determined by other human beings. Other human beings who are in a room, voting. 9 people in a room, voting for the destinies of a whole class of human beings. And if one person votes this way and the other person votes that way and you're down to 4-4 and this one person has that final say and he votes over here, there goes the earthly destiny of a whole group and class of people. We are called by the Lord to advocate and to be a voice for the voiceless, to defend the defenseless, to be strong for the weak. I am no doubt, I know many of them, and if they would be allowed to talk, but maybe they can't even talk, but if they would be allowed to be heard, if they only knew what these people were saying, these people are saying, you don't like living because you're not like me, basically. You're not like us. You have no really right to live. You're kind of in misery. You're suffering. But I have no doubt that a lot of these people, if they could say it, would be saying, I want to live. Let me live. I'm not miserable like you think. Just because I can't do what you do doesn't mean I think I'm missing out. In fact, I don't miss what you're... But they can't say those things. They can't say those things. They need people who think well, think right, who are convicted by God to defend and speak for them, to show them the value of life because they too are in God's image. We think Hollywood is God's image, the bold and the beautiful, the young and the restless, the whatever. That's God's joke is what that is. You spend a week with us at Johnny and Friends Retreat, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. You'll see God's image in a way that you've never seen God before in your life. I guarantee you that. Consider this. Do you realize that you and I may be one moment away from disability? And should you become disabled in some way, shape, or form, should it be then that you no longer have the right to live? Because maybe you can't contribute as much as you could before? Is suddenly your worth diminished? Is suddenly the image that you had of God now tainted, tarnished, erased? There's a writer whose website I was reading who was a writer for a prominent newspaper in Orange County who had become a Christian and then become a Christian and got assigned and was lobbying for and got the assignment that he wanted. He thanked the Lord for it on religion and covering religion. After 8 years of covering religion, he lost his faith after seeing all that the religion, all that there was there and covering that. And he lost his faith and now he has a book called Losing My Religion or something like that. Anyway, I got an email this week with which I will pretty much close here. In fact, you remember John that was here? Did you see his dad? His dad wrote an email to this author in response. Hi Arthur and Pastor Adam. I sent this to William Lobdell, that's the writer, who wrote the book Losing My Religion. Sometimes I think that people like Jonathan, who we just had right here, God's providence, I think people like Jonathan can make a better case for God than I could. So he says, Dear Mr. Lobdell, first I would like to apologize for any attacks you have received from the people in the church. I also want you to know that I'm writing to you as an individual, not as a public figure. God does love you, and any letter that would condemn you for asking questions or trying to make a moral judgment is not proper. We have two basic assignments in life, to find God and to serve Him. I think that arrogance, simplicity, and our own independence often get in the way. But there is a special group of people, a special part of society and our culture, which is often hidden away and shunned, which should instead be brought into the spotlight. This is the world of the disabled. Far from being an argument against the existence of God, they find God. They need God. They rely on God. And as a result, they have a heart and a special ability to serve God. My name is Jeff Rickle. My wife is Chinese. And this is a culture where children have to be perfect. If they are not, they are often justifiably destroyed or hidden away. We have a wonderful 12-year-old named Jonathan. Jonathan means gift from God. In human terms, we would say that Jonathan suffers from severe mental and developmental delays. In God's terms, Jonathan is a masterpiece. Jonathan does not know hate or prejudice. He receives and gives love. If he meets a stranger, he wants to meet them and shake his hand. He wants to make people smile and laugh. If he is with you, he treats you like you are the most special person on earth. When I come home, I don't know whether I will be hugged or scolded by my wife. Jonathan practically throws a parade, shouting, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy." If I had a bad day at work, Jonathan marches in with the biggest smile on his face, and suddenly, the biggest miracle is sitting in front of me. I can't imagine not having that greeting when I get home, the smile and joy when other things are going bad. I really wish I had these handicaps. Children like to be around Jonathan because they know they will not be picked on or put down, just loved and accepted. The church loves Jonathan. Whenever there is a children's concert, he will get up and play a simple song on the piano, and I help him because his hands sometimes get lost. Then he gets up, takes a bow, and he goes like this, and he shouts, "Praise the Lord!" I've seen him accomplish many things the experts tell us will be impossible. When he first walked, it was like winning an Olympic medal. When he wrote his first paragraph, it was like writing a bestseller. When he got up for the first time and played in public, I was there, it was like being accepted into the Pasadena Symphony. We have a friend named Alex. Alex has CP. Cannot walk, limited in functioning, but he loves to talk to people. He tries to find out all about them, and he remembers everyone. He's a greeter at his church. We have another friend named Mo Yi. Mo Yi cannot talk. He only grunts, but he is happy and full of energy. He attacks everything full steam and tries to get you to enjoy life as much as he does. He lights up when he sees his father and keeps pointing to him. Joseph is very high functioning. He has a job in the office. He can talk and he can do simple tasks. He is an usher at our church. There are special camps for families of special needs, children and adults. They were set up by Johnny Erickson Tata. The website is johnnyandfriends.org. Please do some research on Johnny. In the camp, Christians act as missionaries for children and adults with special needs. They volunteer, they pay their own expenses, and they stay with them. They take care of them, enjoy all the activities with them. Joseph volunteers as a missionary for people more severe than he is. Tom has severe CP and he stutters. He can walk, he has one good hand, and most of the time, Tom cannot say a complete sentence. I know Tom too. But let him get on stage and sing, and it's perfect, and it is. Something beautiful, something good. He's amazing. He can play the piano like nothing. Tom is also an usher in the church. There's a singer named Lena Horn. She was born without arms. She has one leg shorter than the other. She has to wear a special prosthetic to walk. She gave a concert for Chinese people wearing Chinese and Western dress and sang in English and Chinese. It was wonderful to hear her sing "What a Wonderful World." These are among my heroes, people I learn from and try to imitate. They need God, and they are used by God. I could give you more examples, but if you're looking for God, Mr. Lobdell, and to see if God exists, this might be a good place to start. These are people and ministries where God seems the most real. God says that He uses the weak to confound the strong, the poor to confound the rich, the foolish to confound the wise. Things happen that could only happen with God. In the Bible, God sends a boy with a slingshot to bring down a super warrior. The world of disabilities is both a question about God and a place where He is often found. Thank you for taking your time to read this. Jeff Rickle. The image of God. If you bother to look beyond the surface, beyond the glitz, beyond the bling, beyond the grades, beyond the area code, the zip code, beyond the name on the shirt, and you start learning how to see people with the heart, you'll know that this commandment is all about God's image. impressed. Now, nobody has it all. Nobody's got the whole package. We have a partial imprint. So we have each other that we need. And when you start putting us together, the mosaic starts to come and fill out clearly. And there you see it. People who want to be there, who want to be there, who are willing to subdue, willing to submit, willing to just to be a part and not the whole thing. People who are willing to be underneath each other and side by side rather than always having to be on top of someone else and better than someone else. Because when you do that, you really kill the image of God, don't you? You commit a form of murder. And I want to say that I've been dreaming for years here that one day, one way, we would be a fellowship here that embraces, that would be unique in the San Gabriel Valley. That there would be a church group that is known, a high school ministry, a high school fellowship group that will be known to the institutions who work with people with disabilities, teenagers, who know that there's this Mandarin Baptist Church over there, some total devotion group, who is set up, who is ready, who is willing, and who has called us, and that they want people with disabilities in their group. I tell you one thing, our group would just be so much better, so much more alive, so much more everything, and God's presence would be here so much more as well, because those who need Him more, what? Get Him more. We need them. And we need to be actively pursuing how we're going to do this. We've made some great strides to start with the Johnny and Friends retreats, with special ed, getting to know people. But I can't imagine doing without them. I need them more than they need us. They've got God in big doses. I need to be near them because I need to be near people who have God in big doses. But those who are self-sufficient, self-reliant, self-resourceful, those who have looks, those who have money, those who have brains, we have little time for God, little faith. That's why Johnny, when she goes to Ghana, South Africa, she goes over there and someone comes out of a mud thatch hut or a lean-to and on there, you know, nothing to her name, but with nothing to her name except this biggest smile that you've ever seen. And she goes, her name is like Amma. And she goes, Johnny, Johnny. And Johnny's, and she goes, got a question for you. You know, why do your people who have so much are so miserable? And they have nothing except the smile of God on their face. We need that. We need to preserve, protect. We need to be able to argue for, defend. We need to be able to think clearly, to advocate for others. Your life is not about yourself. And when it is, you're killing God's plan. That's a form of murder. You're killing relationships. You're killing the community. You're killing the way things are because you want your beeline to success, man. We'll continue in our small groups in a couple weeks and continue this discussion further. Let's pray. Lord, if we would even bother to contemplate and to ponder just what very aspects of yourself that you have decided to invest in us, to give characteristics, to give pieces of your heart to us. You've given us diamonds, and Lord, forgive us for taking your diamonds and playing marbles with them. Oh, would you please grant us the ability and the courage to break through our small-minded dreams and go shatter that glass ceiling to go for your dreams, to go for your desires, which are big. And that you would transform us one person at a time, one mind at a time, one heart at a time. But that you might help us to exalt your image and to give it dignity and to point people to who you are, to who they were made in the image of. And they don't even know it. Remind us of our calling and for why we are here. And I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.